There, now we can start recording for real. So I'm going to go over everything I'm attending to when I see a patient, everything I can potentially see, everything that I'm looking for. So when I do a diagnosis in my clinic, I schedule it for 2 hours. And I spend about the first 30 to 45 minutes just talking to the person. I don't use forms that they have to fill out. You know, people use these very lengthy checkoff forms. I don't believe in doing that, because then what's the difference between that and just a doctor who's just going to look at the forms, meet with the person for 15, their 15 billable insurance minutes, right, and then just leave. I just had a patient with atrial fibrillation who waited 3 months for his medical appointment with his doctor. He filled out all these forms. A nurse spent 10 minutes in the room going over the forms, and the doctor walked in for 5 minutes, shook his hand, said, take Coumadin, and left. So that's not the kind of medicine we want to practice, right? So I spend 2 hours with patients. I'm spending 30 to 45 minutes, sometimes up to an hour, just talking with the person. It's not the information that they're giving me that I care about so much. Does it say, we need a sign on the door saying closed?
I don't know if she's part of the group.
No.
I think the group's full. Right?
No, but we can't sit here all day doing this. So do you have a sign? Can you make
it? It is on the door.
Okay. So I think if other people come, just ignore them. I know the French are very patient, so no one will get upset. So just ignore them. Unless they start like throwing chairs through the plate glass. Right. So I spend an hour with patient, 45 minutes to an hour, asking questions, because it's not just the information people are giving. It's how they're giving the information. So when people are giving information to us, there's the plot, and then there's the theme, right? So the plot is this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened. These are the number of bowel movements I have a day. They're formed, they're loose. I have them at 3 o'clock, and I have them at, that's the plot. That's just the information. In Chinese medicine, we're more interested in the theme. And diagnostically, the theme will be expressed according to the tradition you're practicing. So the theme of a diagnosis, if you're practicing eight principal TCM, will be Zongfu. If you're Zongfu, it'll be a Zongfu diagnosis. If you're doing eight principles, it's going to be in terms of a syndrome pattern. Kidney yin deficiency with liver yin deficiency with fire rising from the gallbladder disturbing the heart. That's the theme, right? That's the theme that the plot expressed. And if it's five element, then the theme is going to be metal within water, or fire within earth, or earth within metal, right? That will be the theme. The general principle is the more angles you can look at the patient from, the more complete the picture you're going to get. So when I'm looking at patients, I'm always looking at Zongfu, I'm looking at eight principle diagnosis, I'm looking at the five element constitution, I'm considering somewhat what stage of heat they have, if I'm considering the six, you know, Tai Yin, Tai Yang, Xiao Yin, Xiao Yin, the different levels of the penetration of cold. And I understand that metaphorically in different ways, right? I think about that in different ways. So you can bring many systems. So the systems we bring as Westerners in the 21st century, we have not just the Chinese systems, but many of us have studied other things. So you may have studied psychology. You may have studied the Enneagram. You may have studied some system of yoga, or the chakras, or American Indian healing. Whatever it is, there are many systems, and you're all looking simultaneously at all these different systems, and hopefully working toward an integration where even though you have many sources of input and you're looking through many, many different lenses, at the end of the day, you have a unified diagnosis. And a unified diagnosis means that you also have a unified treatment plan, because diagnosis is congruent with treatment, right? Once you have the diagnosis, you have the treatment plan. They're the same thing, right? Ideally, it's in your own experience. So once I'm done talking to the person, 45 minutes, let's say 30 minutes if the person doesn't have much to say, okay? So if we just go straight through and they let's say the person's in fantastic health, there's nothing wrong, and they're just coming for well-being, then the whole diagnosis goes very quick. That would take about 30 minutes. But if the person is like the average patient who has four different symptoms and they're on three different medications and they've had two surgeries, then the diagnosis is going to take 45 to 50 minutes. And then if you get a person who has lymphoma, diabetes, and they're on dialysis, and they've had two different kinds of cancer, then the diagnosis could be an hour and 15 minutes. And then, once that diagnosis is done, I take the person's pulse for 30 to 45 minutes. Let's say 30 to 40 minutes per person. And then what I'm looking for in the pulse is how everything we talked about in the original diagnosis is embodied physiologically, and the pulse will also give me everything they didn't tell me. Everything they wanted to hide from me. Everything they don't know about. Right? Everything they don't know about. And everything they didn't think was important. Or everything they represented one way to me that was actually another way. In other words, everything they lied about. Because if patients didn't lie, our jobs would be much easier. Right? But there are two people sitting in the chair. There's the person who wants to get better, and there's the person who's the disease. And the disease has no intention of getting better because it means it has to die. So that's called resistance. So there are two people. There's the person coming with the motivation to improve themselves, and then there's a very significant force in a person, which is the force of maintaining the status quo. I think that's French, so you should all know what it means. Yeah, it's interesting as I talk here, whenever I teach in Montreal, I go, oh, that's French. Oh, that's French. Oh, that's... Do you incorporate like Americanisms into French? I don't know. I guess so, because at the next table last night, the two women talking, we're going in and out of French and English constantly.
Those are real.
Yeah, I was like, what's going on here? She asks in French, she answers in English, then halfway through the sentence, she goes it back into French. It was ruining my eavesdropping. Okay, so, and we're only going to roughly follow this outline today, because this is my standard. We're going to cover all this information, but it may not be in the exact order we're going in. So yes, then I take a person's pulse, and we're not going to cover the pulse, obviously. We won't have time to cover the pulse diagnosis this weekend. That needs a course in and of itself. So what we're going to do is the part of the intake where you're asking questions. So we're going to cover asking, looking, those dimensions of the diagnosis. So having said that, here's the truth. The person walks in the door, I look at them, and I write down the diagnosis. Then I spend the next 45 minutes trying to confirm or deny what I see. So obviously it takes a while to get to the point you can just look at someone and know what their diagnosis is. But the Nanjing, the classic of difficult questions, says that the highest form of diagnosis is to just look and know. Now, even as a beginner, you will have some capacity to do that. So I always advise my students who are beginners to always just look at the person, write down the diagnosis. So if you're doing five elements, you just look and you write down earth, water, fire. You just write it down. But, and you can do it with syndrome patterns. You can do it with acupuncture points. You can just look and say liver 2, pericardium 8. And you can do it with herb formulas. You can just write down, Jia Wei Gui Bi Tang. That's the formula for this person. You write it down. So you're cultivating your capacity to just look and know. But once you write it down, you can't have any investment in proving that's right. That's not the goal. You completely forget about it, and what you try to do is prove that it's wrong. Because otherwise, you're just going to have what's called confirmation bias, and you're just going to try to prove your initial impression right. You don't want to do that. But you do want to cultivate the ability to just shoot from the hip, open the heart, just sense what it is, and just know. So then you have, and then over years and years and years of decades of clinical practice, you'll cultivate the ability to just get to the heart of the matter very, very quickly. And that really is the goal. And you won't do that if you're just thinking. If the process of diagnosis is just analyzing data, then the practice of medicine will only become math. It will only be math. And you don't want it to be math. That's what the practice of biomedicine has become. The practice of biomedicine was not that 100 years ago. When I was younger, there were doctors who still used intuition, but now it's all math. Now it's all protocols and math, and if it's this, do this, and if it's this, do this, and everything's laid out, and the insurance company will only reimburse if they have this illness. You have these three options, and you can do this, and this is the dosage, and that's what you have to, you see? That's not how Chinese medicine is practiced. I'm going to elaborate very sophisticated principles of medicine this weekend. And having said that, you also need to be able to cultivate your intuition, because Chinese medicine is based on science, but it is also an art. We have to appreciate that Chinese medicine is the perfect blend of science and aesthetics. Science and aesthetics. It's both things. So you can't... If you're just using intuition and you don't have a solid grounding in theory and technique, you're going to be out in what we call la-la land. And if you're just using theory and technique and you just have science, you're just going to have another heartless medicine, which is not going to serve people the way Chinese medicine should. Chinese medicine, when it's well practiced, addresses every dimension of the patient with no part of them left behind. And in order to reach every dimension of the patient without leaving any part of them out, that's what holism means. Holistic means no part is left behind. So in order to be able to reach people at that level, we have to have access to every part of our own selves, which means the heart and the soul have to be in the picture when it comes to diagnosis and treatment. Prominently in the picture, fully integrated as a foundation for the practice of medicine. So the very first thing when sitting, the very first thing in diagnosis is just cultivating the capacity to just sit with a person and to have an appreciation for what your experience is that is arising in you, within you, in the presence of the person. This is just prior to all theory of medicine. Is just the capacity to sit with someone and to know. Now, this kind of capacity is no different than in any other art. There are people who can just look at a glass of wine, go like this, right? Sniff it, and just have it touch the tip of their tongue, and that's all they need to know. So when it comes to electric guitars, I can just look at an electric guitar and I can just take it by the neck and go like this and tell you if it's a good guitar or not. And then I at most play one note on it. And it doesn't have to be plugged in. I can just go like this, hit one note, and I can tell you whether I'm interested in it or not. So that's because I've been playing guitar for 45 years, right? So you spend your whole life doing something, you just get a sense. It's very important in our practice, as I said, theory and technique are important, but underneath them as the root practice, as the foundation of all of it, is just the capacity to look at someone, to see, and to be able to feel in your own heart what your sense is. So we want to be able to have a sense of just our general impression sitting with a person. And we are going, and there are some parameters for guiding our sense of the general impression of a person. So the first thing is, how old are they? And what is their level of development relative to their age? The demarcation point of a life is 50 years old. Now that may change in the next 10 to 20 years, because I read that according to what science tells us, it's quite likely my son who is 15 will live to 120, 130 years old. And that will be average for people born now into the middle classes and the upper middle classes, because you're going to have to be able to pay for the organ transplants when you get your new circulatory system, heart, liver, and kidneys when you're 90. But their scientists are just about 6 years away from being able to grow you a new heart from your own stem cells. So that just means when you have heart disease when you're 50, they take a cell from any part of your body, turn it into a stem cell, grow you a heart, and put it back in, and there's no tissue rejection. Okay? But historically, and at this point still, 50 years old is the demarcation point of a life. It's the demarcation point because any human being paying attention, by the time they get to 50, if they're paying attention at all, should start to become aware that they don't have infinite time left. Do you understand? So, you remember when you were 20? You thought you had infinite time. Do you remember when you were 10 years old and school got out? The last day of school, like the distance between the last day of school and the first day of school at the end of summer, seemed like a million years. Do you understand? It seemed like a million years. Okay, so when you're in your 20s, you're still living life, like you can stay up all night, don't need any sleep, can have all the sex you want, can take all the drugs you want, can drink all you want, can eat all the crap that you want, right? Because you think you have infinite time left. You're not thinking that I have to live now to take care of the person I'm going to be. You think it's always going to be like this, right? Always going to be like this. What's all this stuff about going bald and having high blood pressure? And that's for other people. I'm perfectly healthy. It's always going to be like this. But when you're 50, you have enough, you've seen enough in life. You've had enough friends from high school die. You've seen enough in life to know that you don't have infinite time left, which means that by 50, if you're paying attention, you start to mature. Now, if we lived in an ideal world and our parents raised us correctly, we would begin to mature at the age of 13. But if a person's going to mature at all, they should start maturing by the time they're 50, which means that you know you don't have, when you know you don't have infinite time left, it means you start to have to get serious about the serious things in life, like leading a life of meaning and value. Asking and starting to get serious about getting answers to questions like, who am I? Really? Why am I here? How shall I live? Because 50 is the demarcation point of a life, we can understand this in terms of Chinese physiology as it's the turning point in the Jing. It's the time at which fear, it's the time at which we should start overcoming fear and engendering wisdom. So the transformation of Jing is the transformation of fear into wisdom. And wisdom means becoming comfortable in the face of the unknown, because the unknown we begin to face at 50 is our own death, which means we appreciate that we have limited time left. And if we were ever really going to write the book, learn to speak Chinese, learn to play guitar, go visit wherever, right? If we're ever going to do those things, if we're ever going to forgive our fathers or get over what happened to us when we were 14, if we were ever going to do any of that for the sake of something bigger, by the time we're 50, we'd have to realize we don't have infinite time left to do it, and time is of the essence because all of that is in the way of leading a life of meaning and value. So we have to judge each person relatively, where are they in relationship to this. If a person's 20 and they're kind of and they're casual and acting like they have infinite time left, right, and acting kind of immaturely, it's reasonable for a 20-year-old. I wouldn't want it of any of my kids at 20, but on average in culture, it's reasonable at 20. If a person's 47 and they're acting that way, right, and they don't even have to be acting, it's just your sense sitting with them, right? If I'm sitting with a 47-year-old woman who's giggling, which is something that 14-year-old girls do, right? If I'm sitting with a 48-year-old guy and he has an AC/DC t-shirt on, right? And do you understand what? Well, at this point, Angus Young is probably 60, but if he was wearing an AC/DC t-shirt, I just think it was vanity. But you get my point? You want to sit with the person, see where they are. If we lived in heaven, you could take people by age and line them up, and you'd get a perfect line of wisdom. So when you went to the youngest person, they'd have less wisdom, and as you walked and talked to each person, you'd get relatively more and more maturity and depth. And as you got to the end of the line to the oldest person, you'd have soul depth and spiritual self-confidence and transcendent values. And as you went up the line, people would more have a sense of knowing themselves and more of a sense of mission and purpose that they're willing to stand up for, more of a sense of selflessness, more spiritual and emotional maturity, less neurosis, that have overcome themselves for the sake of something better, you see? So you just want to compare a person to that. And it works the other way. when you do get a young person of depth, right? And you also have to note pathologically when you get a young person who's already seen too much. The 18-year-old who's father left home and mother was an alcoholic and had to raise their four siblings. So they're already hardened by life and a bit cynical and didn't get to have a childhood. There isn't the carefreeness that you should see in a healthy 20-year-old. You see what I mean? So we're judging this both ways. So this has everything to do with the transmutation of Jing. We can define Jing philosophically as the fluid that lubricates the graceful unfolding of destiny. The fluid that lubricates the graceful unfolding of destiny. When a person has Jing intact, they're able to go through all the transitions in life smoothly. And when Jing is not intact, they have friction and generate heat, which shows up in their life as torment when they go through transitions. So if a woman has Jing intact and she's going through menopause, she will go through it gracefully. If it is not intact and she goes through menopause, it will be very psychologically disturbing to her, you see, because she's not making this transition gracefully. Similarly, if you have a man who's 50 years old, and he's leaving his wife for the 22-year-old secretary. That's a sign of Jing not being intact. It's a sign of immaturity, you see, of not aging gracefully, of not being able to engender wisdom, but of having a deep investment in remaining immature. So you can cultivate this sense just sitting with someone. So you're always going to, you sit, you look where they are relative to 50 years old. The closer they are to 50, the more transcendence that there should be, the more wisdom they should be, there should be. And then you, in terms of pulse diagnosis, you're going to correlate that observation with their left and right proximal pulses. I'm not going to say any more about that now, but the left and right proximal pulses are the pulses of kidney yin yang and jing. On the left, it's kidney yin yang and jing, and on the right, it's kidney yang. And you correlate these two positions relative. So if you get a 3-year-old with asthma and those positions are feeble, you know it's genetic. Because they couldn't have worked so hard in their life, they used up all their kidney yang by the time they're 3. If you have a 80-year-old with robust proximal pulses, you know they have very strong yang, very strong jing from birth. And by the time a person's 50, if the pulses are somewhat weak, that makes sense, having worked for a whole life. But then you want to see wisdom in relationship. It's all right to expend jing, but the only proof that jing got expended in the right way is that there's wisdom to show for it, not just money in the bank. So if a person reaches 50 and they're rich and very successful in business and their left proximal pulses are depleted, but they're foolish, they're inhumane, there's no soul depth, then from a Chinese philosophical, from a Buddhist and a Taoist and a Confucian point of view, they haven't generated the virtue of the element. They've spent the currency of Jing, but they haven't invested it in a way that has produced personal depth. And you can tell how much soul depth a person has in a minute, in a second. If you listen to AC/DC, and look, the music's fine with me. I would never put it on, but it's all a matter of personal taste. But nobody would say there's a lot of depth there, right? But if you listen to B.B. King hit one note, or Wes Montgomery or John Coltrane, do you understand? If you listen to Glenn Gould play the Goldberg variations, you only have to listen for 3 seconds and you get depth. You listen to James Brown, he starts singing, you go, there's soul, right? Al Green, right? Do you understand what I'm saying? But you listen to some other music, there may be a lot there, you know, that's fun to dance to at a discotheque, but you can tell three notes in or 3 words into a song, you know there's no depth here. So it's the same understanding you can have with a person. And you will have this understanding with a patient to the degree that you've cultivated depth within yourself. You can only see depth to the degree you've cultivated depth. Which is why, in my opinion, if you're going to practice Chinese medicine, you need to study philosophy. You have to have a philosophical perspective, and you need to have some embodied practice, which means that you're serious about yoga, tai chi, meditation. You need some embodied practice. An embodied practice could even be dance. Probably not football. Right? Some cultivation. I should say embodied practice, but I should also say that is cultivational. Right? Qigong, tai chi, yoga, something like that. Okay. So then what is your feeling just sitting with the person? You need to be empty. And if you are empty of self, then you will have room with, if you're empty of your own self, then you will have room within yourself to experience what the patient's experiencing. And you cultivate the capacity to just sit with a person and say, this is just sadness. And it's not my sadness. This is anger. This is grief. This is longing. This is fear. And you feel it, but it's not yours. You're empty of self. And you're just sympathetically, or you could say empathetically, just aware of what the patient is making present in the room, right? You're just aware of it. So these are all just root practices. The thing, and the most significant practice to help make a person empty of self is engaging in an authentic spiritual practice. Whatever that's going to be for you, yoga, tai chi, qigong, meditation. I think meditation in terms of emptiness is the root practice. So having a meditative practice where you just let go, then you can just really bring that, you know, then it, that dimension that of meditation that you're cultivating is actually awakening to a part of yourself that is empty. And if you meditate enough, that part will never leave you, and it will always be available to you in your own experience, so that it's always easy to find, because you're it's not something that you're aware of, it's you. You see? It's not some place you can go, it's actually your own depth. Your own depth. So we want to cultivate that kind of depth to practice this medicine. So what is your sense of just sitting with the person? That will, just sitting with the person gives you a sense of the degree to which they are empty, or to which the degree to which they are full. And then, so that's more related to Jing. Jing is the infinite ocean. Jing is the infinite ocean. And then we want to look at the quality of eye contact, and that's more related to Shen. So between the sense of Jing and Shen, we've established the heart-kidney axis, which is the vertical axis, the core of self. The heart-kidney axis is the core of self. How much ease does the person have sitting? And how much light is coming through their eyes? The ease they have is their depth. A person has authentic ease in life to the degree they're rooted in their own soul depth. You see? And then a person has passion to the degree that their own Shen is rising out of that depth, like the Big Bang, to come into the world in a very positive way. So we want to look at the quality of eye contact the person makes. I have one patient, literally, like if you were me, Anne-Marie, so you say, how was your week? Say it to me.
How was your week?
It was very good. I went to see some movies, and I read this book. I read this book about this philosopher. Have you ever heard of Heidegger? What? You haven't heard of Heidegger? And he's always, I swear to God, he's always staring, and I will say to him, I'm over here. Why are you looking over there? You see? There's no connection. Now, that's a very extreme case. This is a man who smoked pot every day since about 1963. So very deep level of possession. I got him off a pot 3 weeks ago after working with him for 12 years. Because finally his heart condition is so bad based on him having destroyed his own liver, both with pot, and he's a oil painter, so that, you know, the solvents in the paint, turpentine and these solvents destroyed the liver. And I finally said to him, you know, if you don't, you're winding up in the hospital with AFib in the ER 1-2 times a month, you have to stop smoking pot, you have to stop using these paints. Mm-hmm. Go to some other medium. And he finally, after 10, 12 years of working with him, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, finally stopped. And his AFib's getting better now. All of a sudden, he's only having 2 episodes a week, not having to go to the ER. So, but that's just from stopping, and that's just the last 2 weeks, so it remains to be seen what will happen. So you want to look at the quality of connection. A person should be able to look at you and talk you, and right? Just look and talk in the eyes. Right in the eyes. So it would be, I don't mean like this. That would be a little weird. But a person should be able to make eye contact, and there should be a brightness. And that brightness coming through the eyes is Shen. And that is the brightness coming from Ming Men. So in the Nei Ching, the name of Bladder 1 was Ming Men. So GV4 is named Ming Men. But in the Nei Ching, the name of Bladder 1 is also Ming Men. So the reason Bladder 1 was Ming Men is because the acknowledgement is that the brightness, the spirit we see coming through the eyes, is a reflection of how much yang, how much fire there is in the kidney. That explosion coming out of emptiness, rising up the spine of self-awareness, of passion to create in the world. So we want to see these two things in a person: ease and depth on the one hand, and then passion and fire on the other hand. Passion and fire on the other. The other thing we can get by just looking is the iconography that a person is wearing. Do you know what iconography means? Do you know what icon is? I-C-O-N? An icon? An icon is a symbol. It's a symbol. The symbology. If I say symbology, does that... Yeah. Okay, so the symbology that a person is wearing. How is a person dressed? So, just like my class here, this class is like 99% women, but usually there'd be like 30 students and 4 guys. Now there's 15 students and 1 guy, so it's a little low on the 17 and 1 guy, right? 17 and 1. So it's a little low on the male count, but everyone knows our medicine is mostly women, right? Female practitioners and female patients. So the thing is, if a woman comes into me, she's coming into a professional for a medical assessment. So if she's 20 years old and she's wearing 4-inch heels, hot pink stockings, a bright blue mini dress, and she's showing cleavage, I just think, okay, she's a frivolous 20-year-old. But if she's 52 and doing that, that's a little weird, right? Do you understand? Not age appropriate. And because there should be more dignity. More dignity. Likewise, if a guy comes into my clinic and he like just came from his construction job and he's covered with paint from head to foot and he's like totally dirty, that's like a little weird. Like he's not really taking this seriously. That's a little strange. Or on the other hand, it may mean that he's poor. So poor means that he's got a family supporting and it was a big deal to take 2 hours out and he had to arrange it to get right here. But everything means something. Maybe you should put the sign at face level. The sign is not at face level. Maybe if you put a skull and crossbones.
I was going to put a drape, but I thought it was going to be a bit much.
No, this will be fine. I just think the sign was over their head. This will work. What are these?
So you can call me Marie-André instead of
Anne-Marie. Yeah. Oh, well, just... so I can call you what?
Marie-André instead of Anne-Marie.
Anne-Marie. No. Right. Well, I got the Anne and the Marie right. It's just Marie-Anne.
I feel honored.
Okay. Okay, Marie-André. I've only met you 3 times. So.
I'm
joking, too. I know who you are. I just... Okay, let's go on. Let's write the name things later. Okay, so how is a person dressed and are they dressed appropriately? Another way to know if they're dressed appropriately, if someone was coming to your clinic today and they came in dressed in shorts and a t-shirt with no jacket, that tells you the 3 heater is imbalanced. It also tells you they're not taking sufficient care with themselves. But the 3 heater is all about connection to the outside world. My roommate in college, literally, this guy was crazy. I only lasted 6 weeks before I had to get a new room. But this was in Massachusetts in the winter. We had 18 inches of snow last week because we live high in the mountains. Where I went to college had lots of snow. He would wear a bathrobe and go cross campus in February in Massachusetts wearing a bathrobe and no shoes and socks, bare feet. So three heater means connection to environment. So if somebody comes in and they're freezing cold, I mean, it's freezing cold outside, but they're dressed in shorts and a t-shirt, which is not, it could happen, right? Then you want to look for all the other ways they're not connected. On the other hand, I literally have patients who come in August when it's 95 degrees out who are wearing sweaters. Same thing, right? So just looking at that. Then looking at them, I want to see, have they bathed, right? Have they combed their hair? What kind of clothes are they wearing? Are they very tight-fitting, or are they very, very loose? Right? Earth constitution often wears very loose clothing, which is like dampness. Not, right? Nothing fits, everything's overflowing. Right? Nothing's contained, the spleen isn't containing. So all the clothes are very big and flowing, and they're sort of drowning in them, which is another, like dampness. It's an expression of dampness. What are the colors? What kind of tones? Metal tends to dress in all black, all white, black and white, or shades of gray. You see? So it's all about contrasts. Black, everything's black and white, because to the lung and the colon, you're either in or you're out. Right? To the lung and the colon, you're in or you're out. You breathe in air. All the oxygen has to go into the blood, and all the crap gets exhaled. In the colon is taking in amino acids and minerals, and everything else has to get rid of because it's waste. So the metal element creates a black and white context. You're either in or you're out. Self or not self. I'm looking at a person looking at the quality of the skin. Metal in white people, metal tends to have very, very porcelain skin, like Madonna or Marilyn Monroe, for instance. Sharon Tate, if you remember. Those actresses from the 50s with all the diamonds and the very, very, very white porcelain skin. That tends to be metal. Earth has very damp skin. Wood tends toward oily skin, which smells rancid. Fire can be very dry. So we can look at that. We can look at the kind of jewelry a person's wearing. Gold is tonifying. Silver is sedating. People who are really into piercing is fire over controlling metal, or metal going backwards and impinging on fire. Metal going back across the co-cycle. People who pierce their tongue, that's metal impinging on fire, because the tongue is really fire, right? Heart, the heart. We want to look what, if they're wearing rings, what fingers are the rings on, and are they gold or are they silver? Again, silver is cold and sedating, gold is tonifying. If there are any visible scars, we can see what meridians are they across. Is their hair thinning? Which is a sign of Jing, right? Premature thinning of hair would be a sign of Jing. We would say sign of thyroid in the West, right? Then we want to look at tattoos. And what are the tattoos and where are the tattoos? Many people have tattoos that can't be seen in public, which means that they're not comfortable putting it out there and the tattoo is more private. They hold it more privately. But when people have their hands or their face tattooed, then they're making the bold statement, I don't care what anybody thinks. Well, probably that's true on the one hand, but is it really true? Probably not. So we'd have to look for all the... Because if you said, boy, that's an ugly tattoo, they'd probably care what you thought. Why'd you put that on your face? Do you see what I mean? Then all of a sudden, you'd see the whole, I don't care what anyone thinks, is kind of pretense. Do you understand? Or it could be a sign of, like, wanting unconditional love. I'm going to put this here, and I want you to get me anyway. Either way, it's a very fire thing. Very fiery thing. To break social convention in a way like that and not care. And to make the statement. The introductory statement I'm making to you is, I don't care what you think. Accept me as I am. That's a very woody, fiery kind of statement. Then you want to look at the iconography in the tattoos. What do the tattoo mean? Right? Literally, we had, when I was in Worsley's clinic working in England, a young man came in who literally had "love me" tattooed on his forehead, and he had tried to commit suicide by putting his head in an oven, turning on the gas. So do you understand the metaphor? Fire, love me, turn on the gas in an oven. Do you see? So one of the principles of diagnosis, foundational principle, is everything means something. Every gesture the person makes, every word they're saying is being chosen. It's either being chosen consciously or unconsciously. But everything they're wearing, every ring, every symbol, every tattoo, the colors they're wearing, how they sit, how they're relating to you, their eye contact, all of it is being chosen. Now, that doesn't mean consciously chosen, but still chosen. Something's choosing. It's worse when it's not consciously chosen, if it's unwholesome. Do you see? It's worse if they're doing something unwholesome, because that means they're being compelled by forces they're unaware of and they don't understand. So we want to look at the iconography of tattoos. So just even having something like "love me" can be a sign of pathology. It's not just like, oh, love isn't that nice, right? It's sort of a bold statement. So yeah, and then there are, you know, beautiful tattoos people can have, and then there are deliberately negative messages like swastikas or rats coming out of a skull. And then there are just tattoos that people have that are just conditioned by culture, right? So if a person has a Tasmanian devil tattooed on them, you know, the Tasmanian devil, the cartoon, or a unicorn, if a person has a unicorn, that's just some cultural icon that was given by culture. It's thoughtlessness. Do you know, I can read a fair amount of Chinese. You know how many people have Chinese tattooed on them and it's not what they think it means? A word of advice. Never trust a tattooist to translate Chinese for you, because they're probably... not good. You can get a tattoo from Paul Unschuld if he'll give you one, but or Elizabeth Rochat, but you can trust them. But your average tattoo parlor there might just do anything. So you want to look at religious iconography. Religious iconography is very, very important. So by that I mean crucifix, a Tibetan Buddhist bracelet, a Buddhist tattoo, a Christian tattoo, a Star of David. Any religious iconography is very important. The reason it's important is with that symbol, the person is telling you up front what ideals they profess to believe in. So if a person is wearing a Buddhist symbol, that means that their highest ideal is to work for the enlightenment of all sentient beings. That could have, if you're wearing a Buddhist symbol, that means you've given your life to the principle, that you're declaring to the world with a Buddhist symbol that you've awoken to the realization that you have incarnated for the purpose of serving humanity and waking everybody up. Well, is that how the person's living their life? Is that how they respond when you tell them they need to stop drinking coffee? Do they respond from a higher motive for the sake of all people, or do they say, I can't, it's my business, leave me alone? Which would be a completely different motive. Do you understand? If a person's wearing Christian symbolism, they would ideally be making the very bold statement that I'm willing to endure whatever suffering I have to endure for the sake of doing God's work in the world. Do you understand? I guess this is the downside of having a... Usually people aren't trying to bust into my lectures. You know what you should do? You should just sit there and tell them it's $300 if you'd like to come in.
We can get a few more.
Yes, exactly.
You can hang the coats if they're bothering you.
What?
You're the only one who can see it.
No, it's all... It's, no, it's not really bothering. The guy this morning was a bit much, but other than that. Okay, so values are very important. And the reason it's fundamentally important to study this religious iconography, it's only going to make sense to you if you study the religion. So you have to understand at least the root values of the traditions. And if you understand them, then when people wear these symbolism, you'll know what their ideals they're professing to live up to. That's important because you can appeal to those ideals to provide sources of motivation to get people to change in the way they need to change to be healthier. Do you understand? In other words, if you ask a person wearing a gold diamond-studded crucifix to give up coffee and they won't do it, you can put it in terms of making a sacrifice for the sake of others. Now, they might just counter, well, Jesus died for my sins, but that's not being a real Christian, right? The point is that you're supposed to do it. Your ego is supposed to do it, right, for the sake of everybody else's. And the principle here is that in Chinese medicine, we have access to a vast value system of wholeness. Is that fair to say? Chinese medicine system is a values medical. The Chinese medicine is a value system predicated on the value of wholeness, right? Of engendering wholeness within others. Well, the thing is, that's a new value system for all of our patients. That is not is wholeness a Western value system? The Western value system is individuality, autonomy, right? Not communion, right? Not communion. It's individuality and autonomy. I can do whatever I want to do when I want to do it just because I want to do it, and that's my definition of freedom. And nobody tells me what to do, and if you do, you're judging me. See, that's the Western value system. So the thing is, we're teaching people a different value system, and if a person has a value system that they're not interested in living up to, there's no point in introducing anything higher or deeper because they're already not interested in living up to what they're already professing to believe in. So the place to start with everybody is to appeal to the values they already profess to have and get them to live up to those. So when a person's wearing any kind of religious iconography, potentially it gives you a way in to talk to them, to appeal to those values, so they can see that the medicine you're giving them is congruent with the basic values that they already hold. And that's very powerful. Do you see? Very, very powerful way to relate to people. Yes?
If you don't wear any symbols, then do you ask them from what religion are they related to?
No, I wouldn't explicitly ask unless they brought it up themselves. But the only time I'd ask a person, sometimes I ask a person if they have any spiritual practice or tradition. And the reason I'd ask that would be in the context of if they're not wearing any symbols, and the person who comes in is really suffering. So maybe a child just died, or their partner just left them, or they just got a very difficult, potentially very serious diagnosis, and the person is sitting there and they're really suffering, then I will want to draw on their spiritual strength, you see? And if they haven't mentioned anything, then I would ask them, do you have any spiritual value system? Because I've studied all the traditions. As soon as if they say no, then it's no. But if they say yes, then I can immediately talk to them in the words of their tradition in a way that's going to help them reattach them to their deeper convictions. Do you see? Pull on their own conscience. But otherwise, I would not ask, because it would... then it's being intrusive. But if the person's wearing a symbol, then they're out there advertising it. Do you see? So then it's different. So another way that I look at people is I look at people, this might be a new word for you, mimetically. So mimetic, a meme, do you know what a meme is? M-E-M-E, meme? No. You all know what a gene is, right? A gene? Gene? G-E-N-E, genetics? Gene? Genotype? Right? So a gene is a unit of genetic transmission. A DNA-based sequence. Does everyone understand that? Okay, a meme is a unit of cultural transmission. Cultural transmission. We live at a time on the planet now which is very unique, because there are no such things as geographical borders anymore. Right? On my iPhone right here, transcends all geographical borders. I can push Skype and talk to anyone anywhere in the world, and I can research from this phone all web pages on the face of the earth to see every culture and what they're doing on the face of the planet. You understand? So we live at a time in history where all cultures are present, right? So in Montreal 200 years ago would have been Amerindians and white people. But now there are Chinese and Vietnamese and people from Switzerland and people from Scotland and Italians. Do you understand? All living next to each other, eating in the same restaurants and living, going to in the same jobs, right? So all culture is mixing in the whole world. We live at a time when there are more levels of culture than there have ever been, living next to each other for the first time in history. Do you see? So I want to know what level of culture a person is from. If a person asks me, when I have to explain my diagnosis to a patient, if my patient is from Haiti, do you know where Haiti is? Down in the Caribbean, where they do all the voodoo dancing and voodoo rituals. If my patient is from Haiti, I can explain their diagnosis to them in terms of spirits. But if I get a molecular biologist from McGill University and explain the diagnosis that way, it's not going to work. And if I explain to the person from Haiti about the neurotransmitters in the dorsal horn of their spinal cord, then they're totally not going to relate to it. You understand? If I explain a diagnosis to somebody who goes to Burning Man Festival every year in terms of the Ten Commandments, that person's just going to think I'm totally weird and they're not going to get it. Do you understand? But if I explain it to the person at Burning Man in terms of holistic theory and integrated systems, they're totally going to get it. So I have to know, where is the person and what level of culture are they at? Are they from, is their primary identity ethnic? Their ethnic identity? Is their primary identity nationalistic? Is their primary identity tribal? Is their primary identity world-centric? Do they consider themselves a citizen of the world? All of this is going to have a lot to do with how I relate to the person, the information I give them, and what kind of information I give them. Right? Similarly, if I have a patient who's only had a junior high school education versus a patient who has a doctorate in nuclear physics or in politics, a PhD in anything, I'm going to talk to them in a different kind of language and explain things in a different way. So all of this, a significant part of treatment is how we relate to the person. The most significant part of treatment isn't just needles and herbs and diet. Our relationship with the patient is what's creating the entire context for the administration of the medicine we're given. The Chinese talked about this with the characters Tong, Shen, Ming. T-O-N-G-S-H-E-N-M-I-N-G. Tong means to be in communication with, Shen means spirit, Ming means enlightenment. Tong, Shen, Ming means to be so in communication with the patient that you become enlightened to the nature of their spirit. That would be one way of describing it. Another way of describing it would be that the foundation of a practitioner's efficacy, the degree to which a practitioner is effective, is the degree to which that practitioner is in communication with spirit. You understand? Not just the patient's spirit, but spirit coming through to meet the patient's spirit. And the main way spirits meet is through eye-to-eye contact, through actions, and through words. Right? You understand? Okay. You can all feel free to ask questions at any point, too. I just go on, but... And don't feel shy about raising your hand, especially if language isn't clear. Is everyone following me okay? Okay, good. So we want to know what level of culture the person's from, which means you to practice Chinese medicine as a world medicine, you have to be a student of culture. To practice Chinese medicine as a world medicine, you have to be a student of culture. You have to understand culture to effectively relate to people. Okay. Being a good practitioner. So this morning I'm giving you general principles, and this afternoon we're going to go through the whole diagnosis from hearing the person's voice on the answering machine to watching them walk up to the clinic to everything that happens in the clinic to when watching them walk away. Do you see? And then tomorrow we're actually going to see two patients, and you'll see me do everything we're talking about in front of you, okay? So, being a good practitioner is like being a good parent. So those of you who are parents will understand directly what I'm saying, and those of you who aren't parents, if you can imagine what I'm saying. So to be a good parent, you have to know how old your child is and what reasonable behavior is for a child of that age. You have to be paying enough attention to know what a child knows and when they know it. And you have to be paying enough attention to be able to intuit when the next stage of development is coming in so you can encourage it. If you have an 18-month-old child and they take a handful of mashed potatoes and throw it against the wall, you wouldn't want to slap them because an 18-month-old doesn't have has no moral development and they don't know what they're doing. They have no relationship to it. That's for an 18-month-old to take their entire plate, dump it over, throw it on the ground and laugh means they're at exactly at the right developmental stage, right? But if your 9-year-old got upset over something and threw their plate against the wall, well, they're at a different level of development. If you're raising them properly, you've raised them in a way they know that is not acceptable behavior. And then you have to take some action to let them know that's not acceptable. You would never let a 14-month-old know that it's unacceptable to throw their plate on the floor, right? You might say no. But beyond that, you wouldn't do it. You understand? But this is true in all things. You have to know where your patients are in terms of their own development, ethically, morally, relative to this 50-year-old criterion, relative to their age, relative to the education they've had, relative to the relative fortune they've had. You'd have a different expectation for somebody who was not, you know, who was raised by alcoholics, in and out of foster homes, who didn't get a good education, than you rightfully would for somebody who had been raised in a good household and been taken care of and gotten a good education. You'd have a different level of expectation for their behavior, wouldn't you? So if the person without the education had a lot of dignity and depth and intelligence, you'd be super impressed, wouldn't you? But wow, they really have something. They've really done something. This is extraordinary given everything they went through. And if you had a person who had everything handed to them in life, who was immature and had no gratitude whatsoever, you'd say, wow, they're really not living up to, right, the good fortune of this incarnation that they've been born into. They're not taking the right kind of responsibility, whereas this other person has taken a remarkable level of responsibility. I know a man named Gabriel Denbo, who I've been fortunate. I've had dinner with him a few times. He's in his, he must be 25 or 6 by now, who was raised in the Sudan. And he was playing with his friends out in the fields one day and saw soldiers come in and they hid. And they watched as their whole town was burned down and everyone in it was machine gunned to death, all their family thrown on a pile and burned to death. They ran into the jungle and hid. They spent 3 days up a tree with lions circling under it till other people came by. They walked for 6 months to get to the river. What's the river? The Nile River. And they crossed the river with 160 people, 30 of which were eaten by crocodiles. He spent 6 years living in a refugee camp, learned English, moved to New York, went through graduate school, and is now building schools in the Sudan for children. And he will tell you this whole story as I just told it to you. There will be no more victimization than I just told it to you with, without a blink in his eye, and he'll say, I know this is hard to hear, it's what happened to me, but it made me who I am, and my responsibility is to do good works in the world. So that's extraordinary, you see. And then you have other people given everything, and they're totally ungrateful, and they treat you like you're a service bought and paid for, and have no appreciation of your own time or the work you've put into your medicine, you see. So all of this figures in diagnosis. It all figures in diagnosis. So what does the patient know? When do they know it? What values can they hold them to? You want to, when you're treating with a person and they make a step and they hold it, the pulse is getting better, the tongue's getting better, the symptoms are clearing up, but you see them changing in their life, they're maturing, they're growing in a way, they're exhibiting more ease, more passion, more freedom. They're expressing as less of a victim. They have more gratitude. There's more fire in the eyes. They're sitting up more straight. They're more engaged, you see? These are things you have to hold them to. Because it's all right to do that when they're feeling good, but if something comes to be challenging in life, which eventually it will, very challenging, eventually something very challenging is going to come, they're not allowed to go back to where they started. And the tendency will be for them, I've had patients, and you will see this, once you're in practice for at least 3 years, you will see that you will have patients who are doing amazingly well. And if you see them once a week for a year, you will have 52 sessions where they say, doing great, so much better, I love this. And then they will come in one day, they will go, I'm stopping treatment. You go, why? They say, nothing's happening. that 52 pieces of paper here where you came in and testified? And they go, well, I was just saying that. I just, and you go, what happened? Well, you know, I'm just right back to where I started. Nothing's really, and all that's happening is they're on some old feeling state that's being released in a homeopathic sense, you see, and it's coming back into consciousness and being released at a deeper level, and they're just gone right back. Waking up in life, waking up to reality is the easiest thing to do, and it's the easiest thing to forget. It's the easiest thing to do and the easiest thing to forget. So we have to know where our patient came from, attend to them over treatment so we know what the real gains are that they're getting, not just physiologically in terms of symptomatic improvement, but real gain at a level of consciousness, which is Shen, and a level of the soul, which has more to do with Jing. And we have to understand where they've really come to, so when they lose track of it, we can hold them to the highest they've seen. And I think that's our job, is to do that, to hold them to the highest they've seen, just like a good parent, sort of shepherding them along.
So are there patients that you decide not to see?
Well, the quickest I've ever thrown someone out of my office is 2 minutes.
Tell us how.
I say, get out. Well, this has happened with 2 patients. One person sat down in the diagnosis and announced to me, I said, tell me what's going on. And he said, I'm a classical composer and I'm a piano player. I'm working on a symphony and I have carpal tunnel syndrome and can't play, and I need you to help me, and as soon as the symphony's done, I'm going to shoot myself. And I just said, I'm not going to be any part of this. I won't help you. I just said, I will not take this karma on. It's not what I do. You'll have to see somebody else. Another woman came in and sat down. And I said, you know, how are you? We had the pleasantries. She sat down. I said, what's your name? She told me. I said, I'm just going to ask, get a little background for the sake of genetic information. How old's your father? She said, I'm not talking about my family. And I said, well, I don't need any personal details. I just need to know a little bit in terms of genetics. She said, if I have to talk about this, I'm leaving. And I just said, I can't help you. I just said, you'll have to go somewhere else. Because it was just, I could just tell it was just going to be a problem. I could have said, okay, look, we don't have to do that for now. But the thing is, if I had capitulated to that, she would have been in control of the entire treatment process from beginning to end, not me. And that's not allowable. So those are the 2 people I've thrown out. I had 2 other patients. So I have basic rules. When I teach, I'm teaching you like the center of the bullseye, the absolute heart and soul of what I cultivate myself to be able to offer people. That doesn't mean everybody's going to want to engage at that level. In fact, relatively few are going to, but I feel obligated to be able to reach people at the greatest depth and take them all the way, and then to be able to take each person as far as they're willing to go. And when they can go as far as they want and stop, and then they're free and I'm free. But I've had 2 patients, I had to send a letter to them, the same letter to the Board of Medicine and one to my attorney with the CC at the bottom, letting the patient know it went to all 3, telling them they're never allowed to come back to my office again. So I have several rules. You have to show up on time. You have to be polite. You have to follow the rules of the office, which means if I'm not ready, sit in the waiting room and be quiet and take your shoes off at the door. And your check has to clear. Right? Those are the 4 rules. Ideally, you'd have the rule that you have to work hard in treatment. But you can't make people work hard in treatment. As long as they do these first 4 things, I'm good. And the people who, as long as they do that, I'm happy to take their money for as long as they want to pay me to support myself and my family. But where I get my love of the work is with the, you know, 15% to 20% of people who are working hard who will really engage. And then you get some people who work a little bit and don't engage much, and then you get some who don't engage at all, but as long as they do these four things, I'm good. But I had three people, two went into narcissistic rages, screaming and yelling and shrieking at me in my office. And another one, I called her three times during a week and told her her herbs were in, and she didn't come pick them up. And then she called me at home Sunday morning at 7 o'clock and said, I need my herbs. I said, it's my day off, my family's over. You know, my parents were visiting. I said, I'll give them to you when I'm in on Tuesday. And she said, if you don't come in and give them to me, I'm going to kill myself. So I said, okay. And I went in and I met her and I gave her the herbs and then sent her a letter saying, never come back. Anyway, you have to have some boundaries. I will advise you, if you're in the beginning of your practice, that the one patient you have who acts this way will ruin your love of the other 300 people. Not the people, but it will ruin your enjoyment of your practice, this one person. So I've been practicing 30 years. I've thrown 5 people out of my office. That's not a bad record, right? One every 6 years. It's been about 6 years, so maybe I'm due. And the sooner, when you identify a patient like this, the sooner you get them out, the better.
I was wondering sometimes when they call, but maybe you have a receptionist.
No, I don't have a receptionist.
Are you ever on the phone thinking, oh, I don't think this is
going to
serve anything?
Yeah, and then I'll casually say maybe you should see somebody else, but I'll give people on the phone the benefit of the doubt unless they're being jerks. Anyway, so moving on. So there are just some basic qualities in humanity. Shame, conscience, pride, arrogance, fear. All these basic things, you want to be able to know what they are and just sense them in people just sitting with them. When people want feedback sometimes during a diagnosis, they'll talk about something, a dilemma in their life, and they'll say, what do you think? And my response will often be, how does what you just said sound to you? And I'm always interested in the degree of objectivity a person can have about it. So if a person says something that's completely contradicts itself, right? So they make a statement that is like two different people talking. It's like crazy. They say, I really love my husband, but he can be a son of a bitch. Do you see? I really love my husband, but he can be a son of a bitch. They didn't sell that very... The I really love my husband part didn't go down very well. So they're ambivalent. There are two different people talking, you see. So sometimes I'll just say, how does that sound to you? And if they say, boy, I'm really divided, then I know at a level of consciousness they can see themselves, and that's good. If they say, I don't know what you mean, how does it sound to me? I'll say, well, you just said something. If you were outside the room listening, oftentimes people don't know what they've just said. So then if I give the feedback, well, you said, I really love my husband, which is one message. But then when you said sometimes he can be a son of a bitch, there was real bitterness and resentment. And the part of you that said that doesn't love him at all, then you see how maturely can they take that feedback. You see? So another thing I want to observe is when a patient is very upset, they're really suffering, they're really upset over something, I want to know how quickly can they shift their attention to the part of themselves that isn't suffering. The ground of who we are, the fundamental basis of who we are, the root of the self, the root of who we really are, nothing ever happened there. It has nothing to overcome. It isn't sick. It wasn't sexually abused. It wasn't abandoned. It wasn't betrayed. It wasn't raped. It wasn't cheated, wasn't lied to. The fundamental ground of who we are is free of everything and anything. That is the ground we wake up to when we meditate. You have to have enough experience as a practitioner with authentic spiritual practice, and particularly meditation, to know this dimension of yourself with no ambivalence. This can't just be a theoretical construct to you. We really, as practitioners, need to be awake to the dimension of ourselves, which is empty. This is the fundamental insight of Asian culture. It's the fundamental insight that Chinese medicine came out of, you see, of emptiness, of being. All of Asian medicine is rooted in this fundamental insight from Taoism, and which was much more greatly elaborated later by Buddhism, of this empty dimension of the self. So because I know that dimension of my own self and I have conviction in it, right? Unwavering conviction in it. Because I know that dimension of myself, because it's never any further away than the tip of my nose, I know that dimension in all of you and in everyone I meet and in all of my patients. I know that dimension. How in touch with that dimension are they themselves? So when a patient is really suffering, I want to see how quickly their attention can shift to a part of themselves that isn't. Because it's always there. Now, that doesn't mean if a person comes in all upset and you say, what's going on? And they say, my son was hit by a car yesterday and is in a coma and they don't know if he's going to live. You don't go, don't you know nothing's ever really happening? Just shift your attention to this part of emptiness. So I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about that. Right, I'm not talking about that. But the point is that even if a person was that, if a person with a profound enough rootedness in that dimension, even if that had happened, there'd still be some presence of it in their demeanor. I mean, Nelson Mandela spent 28 years in a prison, in a jail cell, a little bigger than this table. I mean, if you ever saw the cell he was in, it's like 8x10, right? So, you know, but when you would listen to him speak, there was total dignity, total peace, total conviction. So because I've cultivated this in myself, when I'm talking to a person, I'm always, when I'm talking to, no matter how set a patient is, this is the point, no matter how upset a patient is when they're talking to me, I'm not going to move. No matter how upset they are, I'm always speaking to them from emptiness, from the dimension of my own self where nothing has happened. Now, that doesn't mean I don't have emotion. It doesn't mean sometime I won't get teary. It doesn't mean I won't say, God, that is just awful. I'm so sorry this happened to you. But it's coming from a non-victimized dimension of my own self. So I'm only relating to the patient ever from a part of myself which is not a victim. And when you relate to a person that way, really authentically, you're speaking to the part of them that isn't a victim. And when you do that through resonance, which is the foundation of our medicine, by me putting my attention on the part of myself and themselves, which isn't a victim, it will pull their attention to that dimension of themselves. And I just want to see how quickly can they make that shift. Do you see? How quickly can they make them that shift? The quicker, for a break, the quicker they can make the shift, the better the prognosis is at the level of consciousness. The better the, that doesn't mean their diabetes is going to get better. It doesn't mean their back pain will get better any quicker or more slowly. It just means at the level of consciousness, you have a same clear energy to work with coming from the yuan shi, the jing, and the shen. You see? Coming from the yuan shi, the jing, and the shen. Okay, so good time for a break? Perfect, thank you.